You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PLL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo back here with Sam Monson and with our special guest, Paul Alexander, former offensive line coach of the Cincinnati Bengals, a little bit with the Dallas Cowboys. But Paul, thanks for joining us. We're talking all things offensive line here today.
No, this will be fun.
Yeah, this will be great. Paul, what are you doing these days?
Well, I guess officially I'm retired from coaching, but I work with players. Shoot, I've been around the world. I've been to Europe twice. I've been to Australia. I've been to the UK a couple times, and I've been to a couple hundred American colleges. And, I work with, two dozen different NFL players and so forth.
Awesome. That's great. So we'll talk a little bit about the rookie offensive linemen, some general offensive line discussion. And then I broke out my Cool Clinic shirt.
At some point, you're going to explain what you're wearing.
It's a, maybe Paul can explain it. Why do I have a mushroom that says cool under it? This is like your thing here.
Well, that is a clinic that has been going on for 30 years now, at least. Coaches of Offensive Line, COOL. And the moniker is a mushroom where, you know, the same old thing, line coaches are, you know, just fed a bunch of garbage and kept in the dark. So it's a society of offensive line coaches that we encourage each other. And because usually we just get garbage.
I thought you were trying to get one of those, you know, mushroom coffee sponsors that keeps flooding my timeline on like Facebook and Instagram or whatever. People trying to convince you to drink mushroom coffee. There's some sort of. It's great health benefits, Steve. That's what
you
want.
I could be interested, and I could wear the shirt.
That's what
type of mushrooms?
I have no idea. All I know is I've seen the ads.
Psychedelic coffee?
And every time it comes up, my only thought is, I will never, ever try that. It doesn't look nice.
I'll try almost any kind of coffee, so we'll see. I mean, so you guys invited me into your society. I'm a four-time keynote speaker at the Cool Clinic, so... Got the shirt and everything. I figured it'd be a good day to wear it. It's not good. You're not supposed to wear white on TV, they tell you. But
well, particularly not with a white background.
Look, it wasn't perfectly planned out, but we're having some fun here.
Okay.
We're gonna talk some O-line.
All right.
So Paul, let's talk a little bit about your history with PFF grade. So you're with the Bengals for how many years?
23 years.
23
wow.
years.
Yeah.
Then PFF shows up on the scene and we start grading your guys that only the Cool Clinic type of people can grade,
it's
right?
Like the whole Tom Brady career.
It really is. Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, you may not even know this. Where Neil Hornsby, who was the founder, first connected. You know, he was doing PFF out of his garage, I guess, over in England. And all of a sudden, these things pop up, you know. And I started watching them. And I would look at it. I'd say, okay, my left tackle's going against so-and-so this week. Let me pull up all the grades. Well, hey, Joe Thomas blocked him good. This guy blocked him good. He blocked him good. Oh, he didn't block him good. So I would first get a head start on what film to watch. And then I would tell the players, I'd say, hey, you better watch this game and that game if you want to see the problems. If you want to see how he was blocked well, watch this game. And then I got more where I would start knowing the players. And I would say, you know what? don't even watch these games because your technique isn't like those guys, you know. Your technique's like these guys. Watch those games, you know, and how they did. So I would use PFF, and I messaged back and forth with Neil when he was in England, and we became very close then, and it's carried on until this day. I love PFF right from the beginning.
And who would have thought we'd all move to Cincinnati so we could all be neighbors now, right?
I know, it's crazy.
Because you're still living right down the street here, and we're all neighbors. So you've, when you were in Cincinnati, the play-by-play grading and various things like that, what have you seen? Because we take a lot of criticism, believe it or not. A lot of people criticize us here at PFF, and particularly with the offensive line grades, right? You don't know what we're doing. You're not in the meeting room. You don't know our technique and blah, 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 blah. So what have you seen as far as, besides just preparing, are we at least getting in the ballpark as far as describing what you're seeing on the field as well?
Here's what I say, and I've said it before, that I have access to the PFF data and video, and I pull things up, and I might pull up, Jonah Williams, right, and watch all of his positive graded plays, you know, or I might watch all of his negative graded plays, and I got to tell you, it's somewhere around 95% accurate. It really is for what I would have graded it.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you're not. Okay. Well, there's a small percentage of those plays where it could be, we don't know exactly what they're doing. But I've always said that when you expand it out over 1,000 plays, everyone's got a couple of those plays.
Of course.
And so they all become a wash. And so I've been a huge proponent of PFF. I used it in my coaching, and I use it today.
Well, we appreciate it. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've always made that point, right, that there's a huge amount of value from just doing the process and documenting every play. And sure, there's always going to be some plays where if you're not in that meeting room and you don't know the specific, you know, weird adjustment they're making for this one player or this one scheme, you're not going to be able to get it right. You're going to be led astray. But that's going to come up two times in that one game over 1,000 snap season. It's like a tiny, tiny margin for error that's only really affecting this one game a couple of times. And even then, you might not even grade it badly. You know what I mean? It might not be a dramatic difference from if you were grading the exact adjustment that they were assigned, but just the act of documenting it rather than sort of watching the game and sort of going through and just mentally thinking about, was that good? Was that bad? Where did you come out? I think there is value in that. And I think that's the bit that people kind of get lost in the weeds and don't focus on, like, just the overall good that comes from it.
I think it's great. I mean, I say this. I say, okay, I study pressures on quarterback, right? They sit there, they watch. Did the guy hit the quarterback? Yeah, he hit the quarterback, right? Was there pressure on the quarterback? Yeah. Was it a sack? Yeah. Right? Anyone can kind of see that, right? Yeah. Can you put a stopwatch and see how long it took the quarterback to throw the ball? I think just about anyone can do that, right? So yeah. You take, and those are the things that I think you're looking at as much as anything, you know, the things that are quantifiable and, you know, not necessarily subjective.
One of the tricky things that you know, like you're in a meeting room the day after and you know the nuance and where the quarterback's supposed to be and all that stuff. We do take a lot of time looking at those plays. For instance, like week one, Tyron Smith had a play. There was pressure on the interior. Dak kind of, you know, spins out a little bit. And Tyron Smith's blocking his guy, who sees the spin out, and then he sacks Dak Prescott. And we're like, hey, Tyron Smith didn't give up any pressures. It wasn't on him. That was losing leverage and all that stuff, right? How often do you see that? I mean, you don't have to interact with fans, I don't think, as much as we do when they're complaining about our stuff. But how many times do you see that where, like, it looks like the left tackle is beaten until you understand, you know, the nuances of what's happening?
Well, you get a lot of that in the, when you're watching the commentary on TV.
Right,
you
know, right.
And it's kind of hard to tell from the live shot commentary exactly what's going on. But when you go back and you watch the video and the film and you break it down and you have a better chance of getting it right.
One of the big sort of topics of discussion this year in the draft was Penei Sewell, who started off, I think, as this kind of consensus number one top tackle available, generational talent. And then kind of up on the rails came Rashawn Slater, and suddenly there was a group of people saying Slater might be the best tackle in this draft class. Where were you on those two guys now? And has the first couple of weeks of NFL action changed your mind at all on either of those?
You know, it's funny. Sewell, Sewell was such a great player for so long. And I know you guys had him as a blue grade through his whole career, which was unbelievable from his very first games as a freshman in college. And so that was always a good indicator to me that he'll adjust quickly to the NFL, because as a freshman, he was good. Right. He was rare. He had a magnificent offensive line coach at Oregon, right, who really teaches modern protection techniques, right? Meaning, I call them modern. I call them independent hands techniques, right, which is tailored for today's rushers. Rushers, they use hand knockdowns. They use spins. They use the new one this year. Everyone's doing the hop chop, right? They're doing, you know, the Aaron Donald hop. They're all doing it. And you see everyone doing it. And the independent hands is a more progressive, newer technique form. Well, he knew those things, you know. Most of the college guys, they set, they turn, they two-hand punch, which in pro football doesn't work, right? They're so good with their hands that they knock your hands down, they make moves, you miss targets, you know. So anyways, so I knew Sewell was going to be top shelf. I liked him better than Slater, and this is why. Because when I first started putting my list together of guys to go work out with, I trained 34 of the, 46 offensive linemen that were drafted this year in the offseason. Wow. And so I knew them all. And I didn't approach Rashawn because I was told when I was putting my list together, they said, oh, no, he's a guard. He's not a tackle. So I kind of – he slipped by me a little bit. I only did him on video. I didn't do him in person. I did Panay in person. And I found this out from watching – let's talk about Slater a little bit, all right? This guy is fascinating. Everyone was concerned – those who – had concerns with Slater was his height and his reach. And his body looked more like a guard than a tackle. You know, he wasn't the linear type guy. And so the question would be, you know, how is he going to block the long guys, you know? The guy. And so in the opening game, the Chargers are playing the Washington team. And who does he get? He gets Montez Sweat. Now, Montez Sweat is the longest leverage rusher that you could imagine. He's one of the very best. And if a shorter guy would have a hard time with anyone, it would be Montez Sweat.
Let me get some actual numbers here. 98th percentile arm length, 35 3/4 arms for Montez Sweat. So when you're going up against him at 98th percentile arm length among edge defenders historically.
I know. It's like you blocking him. You know what I mean?
I win. I would win unless you've got some, low man wins sometimes, but,
cut block. Like taking these out.
There you go. And so I was concerned, the first two plays of the game, right? The very first two plays of the game, Sweat comes, he bull rushes him, he long arms him, you know, he kind of pushes him near the quarterback. It wasn't a pressure. It could have been graded maybe a pressure, but it wasn't, all right? It was kind of close, two of those. And then I go, okay, all right, yes, Slater, you're going to have a hard time with these tall guys, huh? And then I'm watching more. Well, the third time they went against each other, he gives him the long arm, and Slater obviously has shorter arm, so instead of trying to grab his chest, he just grabbed underneath his arm, and he picked it up, and he stopped the force. And they did it again. He did it again. He did it again. So he adjusted how to block that type of rusher, which was a concern. You know, it's amazing that he would get the ultimate challenge in this very first NFL game.
Right.
And I think he graded 20 for 20 in that game. I think he
didn't give up a pressure.
Yeah. He did a great job in that matchup. So
and he's the perfect. Yeah, he's the perfect example of this because he's got that 33-inch arms. You know, right at the borderline. When NFL teams are like, nope, we're not interested. You're going to have to move inside to guard. And if he's able to overcome all that and be as good as he looks like he is through 2 weeks, I mean, it's great for that, for the people that rail against that. Like, just stop looking at arm length, you know?
He like Sewell, uses independent hands techniques, right? I just classify him that way. When the arm length was so important, and I'm a proponent of arm length, right? But I used to be more of a proponent of arm length because back when everyone punched, you know, if you were longer than me, I couldn't get your chest. My arms were long enough, you know, but now it's more of like wrestling, right? These techniques, you know, you let the guy touch you and then you get your hands in the right spot and you just grab him and move your feet, you know? And so he's able to do that. If he didn't know those techniques, if he was just setting and two-hand punching everybody,
He'd be in trouble.
Excuse me.
Right?
He'd be in trouble. Yeah.
So Penei Sewell, who you said you liked him coming out, obviously. We graded him well. We liked him. He looked like a generational kind of tackle. I hate using the word generational, but he was the best guy that we had graded as a freshman and as a sophomore. All of a sudden, the Lions draft him. They have Taylor Decker at left tackle. They move Penei to right tackle. I do want to talk about that in a general sense. But did you see Penei in the preseason? What was happening in right tackle? He was not comfortable, to say the least.
He was poor. I think he was a yellow, right? He was a yellow player as a right tackle, which yellow.
Which means what?
It means, to me, yellow. In your the way I interpret your colors, I may be completely wrong, right? But if a guy's a blue, I say he's like a top shelf player, yeah. Right? If a guy's green, he's good, right? He's a starter, right? If he's a yellow, maybe he shouldn't be. If he's an orange, if he's a red, he was. Right? Well, that's how I look at these.
Penei was getting into that orange and red territory in a small sample size in preseason and just did not look comfortable at all.
He did not. And, you know, it's kind of funny, the whole timing, everything. Even Orlando Brown on the left, his footwork isn't right. You know, that's why he's had a rough go of it so far, you know, flipping over on the left side against speed guys. And it's different for guys. Some guys, and it depends on them. You know, the question is, can guys flip? Well, I think you need evidence that shows a guy can do it.
Yeah.
You better work him out and see if he's natural at it, all right? Or he better have played it at some point. Or did he, even in high school, if he played on that side? Because I had guys that could go left, right, and it without any pause. But I've had guys that, no matter what, they could never play on the other side after being on that other side their whole life.
The working
it depends
out,
on the guy.
The working out part is a good. We kind of asked this question just between the two of us who have no idea the other week. If you're a team looking to draft a guy and you know there's a pretty good chance you're going to have to move him from left to right or right to left, when you're doing that workout, are you running him through the other side?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Good. Because that makes sense, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Sometimes, like with a guy like Sewell, he was so bad at right tackle, you're kind of wondering, did they check? Like, did they just assume that this was going to be okay? Or did they actually work him out and make sure that he could?
Well,
he
who knows right? with the COVID workouts, what right. was going on, you know, but, yeah, so that was a concern. But they went over to the left. And let me tell you, he went up against Bosa in the first game. Now, to me, Bosa is the hardest rusher, the 49ers Bosa, is the hardest rusher in the league to figure out.
Really?
Right? The hardest. Because he has elite bull rush and he has elite moves. Right? Most guys are usually one or the other. Chase Young, who I think is terrific. In fact, when I saw Chase Young in Ohio State, I say reminded me of Lawrence Taylor. I was the one who said that, you know. So I obviously have great admiration for Chase Young. But Chase Young is more of a move guy. Okay, well, you can use a little different techniques to block him, you know. Sweat is kind of a power guy, you know, so you can use different techniques to block him. Bosa has both. All right, so you got to be absolutely perfect on top of your stuff. Okay, so what happens? Well, he goes out against him, and my God, one play he runs right into him, and Sewell crumples Bosa like he's a freaking statue just turning into dust, you know what I mean? And then the next time Bosa goes, okay, the next time I'm going to run right at him, and they'll jump inside quick on him, you know? And Sewell went like a cat, and it was like, whoa! And same thing, got his hands up, you know, put him on the ground. And so a matchup like that, it's kind of amazing. Those two guys, the matchups they had in the openers.
Tested, you know, right away, right?
I mean, it's like, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more first-round offensive lineman. We'll get into Alex Leatherwood. But first, week two of football is in the books. It's time to review the tape. Get ready for week three with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. To kick off another action-packed week, DraftKings is giving new customers $150 instantly when they bet $1 on any football game. Listen up. You don't want to miss it. Head to DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Place a bet of $1 on any week three game. Paul, you could do this if you're a new DraftKings user here. You actually can't because you're in Ohio. But you receive $150 in free bets instantly. If it's not available in your state here in Ohio, Paul, like it's not, DraftKings still has huge cash prizes up for grabs all season long with their daily fantasy contests. DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with their first deposit. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use promo code PFF to receive $150 in free bets. And you place a $1 bet on any football game. That's promo code PFF this week at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. And then you go like this. Must be 21 or older. New Jersey, Indiana, or Pennsylvania only. New customers only. Minimum $5 deposit and $1 wager required. One per customer. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. If you have a gambling problem, you call 1-800-GAMBLER or in Indiana, 1-800-9-WITH-IT. We just had to pay some bills.
Wow. See, you tried to show off and you butchered it. You stumbled.
They tell you to be natural, interact with the guest and stuff like that, right?
I'm just saying, like, if
I'm not a pressure player at all.
Displaying in front of people, you need to be able to see.
Hey, I'm the worst better. We once had, during a bye week, we did a little pool about 10 years ago with
everyone
in the neighborhood. You know, that was before the rules, right? Oh, okay.
He's retired now. He can't get him now.
Me and Pete Rose used to.
There's got to be a statute of limitations.
Yeah, statute of limitations.
I mean, everyone put a buck in. You know what I mean? And I'm not kidding you. Of the 20 neighbors in our neighborhood that were in it, I came in last. Last 20 out of 20. My wife came in like third because she likes she likes the color of the Vikings helmets.
See, it's a good thing we can't gamble yet in Ohio here.
My mother was on like an 8-year streak of picking the Super Bowl winner just from like the helmets or the colors or the name or whatever. I had no idea who any of the teams were, any of the players, but was like 8 for 8 for a run, and then the wheels fell off.
Yeah, old saying, he who bets on NFL games lives in paper boxes.
Well, you just need the PFF data to give you the edge.
Yes, the PFF green line will certainly help you. Over at pff.com, then you'd you'll have a beautiful house, actually. Somebody in the YouTube comments is taking your joke here, Sam. Panay Sewell at left tackle has DirecTV.
Yeah, there
Panay
you go.
Sewell at right tackle has cable, uh-huh. Those old DirecTV commercials. So Sewell has looked good at left tackle. Slater has looked good at left tackle. Slater, a 67.8 PFF grade, highest pass blocking grade of any rookie offensive line so far. By our numbers, Sewell, 71 overall grade, solid at left tackle. I don't know what the Lions do when Taylor Decker is healthy, though. Do you have to move Sewell back to right tackle?
Well, so that was what I was going to ask, is he looked terrible at right tackle. Is that something you would expect? Like, how long would you expect that to last? Is he just a guy that's probably going to struggle there always? Or was this something that, 6 weeks in, he's going to look way more comfortable? Or, if they hadn't got, I don't want to say caught a break with, their left tackle getting injured, but if they hadn't had to move him back to left tackle and he'd been playing 2 weeks at right tackle, it was looking terrible. Like, how long would you expect that to last?
If I'm the Lions, you don't move Sewell. He's your left tackle for the next 15 years, and I'd trade Decker.
Wow.
That's what I'd do.
How much – I've been suggesting that they move one of them, and by one of them I mean Decker, into left guard. Like, where are you in the idea that moving from left tackle to left guard is harder or easier than moving from left tackle to right tackle, in a vacuum, right? Without any sort of evidence that either guy has done it in the past or any of that kind of stuff.
I think we'd have to go back. You'd have to get him out there and you'd have to see how natural he is.
Yeah.
And you could tell within 5 minutes if a guy's natural or not.
Wow.
It is a completely different skill set, right?
Yeah.
When we're talking left tackle, right tackle. I mean, left tackle, guard versus tackle and the whole thing.
Yeah.
Real quick on the left tackle, right tackle thing. I spent the entire offseason telling people that free agent Alejandro Villanueva would solve various tackle problems across the NFL. And then the Ravens signed him. And at first I was like, okay, finally somebody signed Ali Villanueva. However, it happened to be the Ravens who were going to flip him to the right side after 6 years at left tackle. And he looked pretty bad in his first game. But he moved back to left tackle and redeemed himself on Sunday night. So that's another one. You've got a veteran that moved from left to right. And he looked pretty bad.
It's hard. Some can do it, some can't.
Yeah.
That doesn't have the easy answer, though, because now Stanley's going to come back at some point.
Right. So there's two teams now that have, there's like four left tackles between the Ravens and the Lions,
yeah.
Right? And they have to figure out what to do at the right side. From an analytical standpoint, there are so many guys who play left tackle in college because they're generally better than the right tackle. They get drafted and then they play right tackle in the NFL and they're fine. Like Mitchell Schwartz was a left tackle in college. Almost everybody was. So from an analytical standpoint, I think it's easy for us to say, well, this happens all the time. But then you'd get an individual who just, whether it's the footwork or just
what about
he's unbalanced power-wise, whatever, like there's something missing from some people, right, when they're switching?
I mean, whatever. How crazy was it, Louisville that used to switch tackles? Was it play drive? They used to play strength with the tackles, right? So they would flip them.
Back in the day, like
that's
when
how
I
they
was
used to
young,
play football, right?
Yeah, in the 70s and 80s, everybody flip flopped. They
right.
had a strong and weak line. Most, not everybody, but 75% of the teams did. And then there's just a couple today that still do. And the techniques are trickier, and it's probably good they don't. And but one of the big problems is, okay, if I've been playing left tackle since I was 14 years old, right? Well, I've strengthened up the muscles on my right side of my body more than the left side of my body. Right? Now all of a sudden I go over and I play on the right, and the left side of my body is weaker. That's not good.
Right.
You know, and you get a muscle imbalance.
People one of the things for Donald Penn, right? He flipped over sides and then immediately
it's a strength imbalance. One of the guys, the best guys to manage is Andrew Whitworth. Andrew Whitworth is a left tackle. He's a tremendous athlete. You know, he's darn near a scratch golfer, but he's a left-handed guy who hits the golf ball right-handed. Right. And he did that because when he was a kid, those were the clubs that were in the garage, you know, so he learned how to play golf. He's a scratch golfer, right? He's a lefty. And what's funny is every day in the off season and OTAs, after he goes through OTAs, he goes to the golf range and hits a bucket of balls. And he says it's so that he keeps both sides of his body strength kind of strong, kind of like I know you had a relationship with Tom House. You know, they throw the towels with the right hand, they throw them with the left hand, you know, to maintain equal balance in their body. I think that NFL players and strength development and trainers need to do that more with players.
Yeah. You know,
Whitworth says that's the reason why he's played so long and has been pretty much injury free, because he hasn't weakened one side of his body.
I don't want to get off into the pitching. So my shtick here is to always make baseball analogies, but a right-handed pitcher, it was always fascinating to me because I just did the same thing over and over and over again. It was like so different than other athletic moves. Like a quarterback has hundreds of throws that he has to make, and some under pressure and some on, like I'm just throwing the same three pitches, plate never moves. So I figured like in your body could be, you know, out of balance because I'm doing more specific things, but it's not healthy to be in the same thing. If you just, like you're saying, if you just train for left tackle, it's tough maybe to flip sides. The other guy that flipped sides this year is Alex Leatherwood, the other first round pick with the Raiders. What have you seen from him so far? His PFF grade a little bit worse than the other guys. He looks like he struggled at least by our numbers so far.
Yeah, he doesn't look natural over there right now.
Yeah.
His pass sets aren't crisp and clean. It's almost like he's backpedaling, kind of feeling his way out and measuring the guy he's going against rather than, they're really good pass blockers. They set with authority to a position, we call it a spot, and they force a rusher to rush how they want him to rush, and then they react, right? But he's not there right now. Right now, he's kind of just backing up and seeing whatever's happening. You know, here's another baseballer, right? I once had a ticket at the diamond seat, you know, down at the Red Stadium, and I'm sitting 10 yards away from home plate. And the most amazing thing that I got out of that was when those guys get in the box, I mean, there could be a firecracker going off and they're not going to flinch.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what really good NFL tackles look like, you know, and Alex doesn't look that way right now when he's setting.
Yeah. So when you're evaluating linemen, you're seeing them getting to a spot in an athletic position and ready to handle whatever's being thrown at them, right?
Yeah.
Where you see guys, like when they seem like they're playing catch up with their footwork or whatever, it's generally curtains.
Yeah. You can see it in their eyes. Ooh, you really can. You can see in their eyes what they're doing. When I work with the guys, I say, okay, pass protection is this, right? In pass protection, the most important thing you need to know is you block a spot, meaning the place where you're setting up. You block a spot, you don't block a man. And where players fail time and time again is that they're judging the guy they're going against on their way to the setup spot.
Yeah.
And the defender, his job is to try to prevent that blocker from getting to his spot.
Yeah.
So they do head fakes and jabs and euros and, you know, all kinds of stuff, right? So the really good guys block the spot and then they worry about the man. And that's where you can see if they're at that level yet. And Alex isn't at that level yet.
You might be able to help with this. We have a live YouTube question here. Somebody's asking. He needs a spot for his first anniversary. He's in the Cincy area. He wants to bring his wife to someplace for. And somebody actually suggested Jeff Ruby's. I'm going to say Jeff Ruby's just because I want that Ruby sponsorship.
What did this show just become?
Doesn't matter. Now, like, I'm responding to our, and give us the thumbs up if you're live on YouTube. But he needs a nice place to go. Any off, you know, you can think about it. But if you have any hidden
take
gems
her to
here,
Skyline Chili.
Skyline, yeah. There we
where
go.
It is. She'll Skyline. Love you for it.
Jeff Ruby's or yeah. Skyline Chili.
Nothing will be happening that night if you take her there.
I'm trying to help the people out here. Okay. Guys in the Cincy area, he's trying to figure out where to go. I want the Ruby sponsorship, though, too. Yeah.
This show is like labeled all things offensive line. I'm not sure that qualifies. Mm-hmm.
Well, people, they tuned in for that.
Yeah.
What about O-line development across the NFL right now? Where does it stack up from 15, 20 years ago, the depth, and feels like it's challenging?
I have a hard time because I'm retired now and I'm getting on the other end of life. And typically guys who get on the other end of life think nothing's as good today as it used to be. So I try to remain as completely objective as I can.
It's good self-awareness, but, by the way, that you have that. Yeah, that's good.
But it's not as good.
Yeah.
It's not as good in college. It's not as good in pro football. There's less hitting in practice. There's less, just a matter of toughness and so forth, that you don't have as much time to work on technique work. There's not the attention to time and detail in blocking techniques that there was at one time. So it shows up. It doesn't look good to me in a lot of ways. It really doesn't.
So the kind of struggles, there seems to be, whatever about the overall level about offensive line play right now, there definitely seems to be a depth problem in the NFL. I think there's also a depth problem or a development problem with quarterbacks, certainly. Is this all just a product of, you know, the CBA constantly chipping away at practice time and how much hitting players can do and how much time you can actually work with guys, you know, with the aim of prolonging players' careers and not exposing them all to unnecessary quote-unquote hits? But is this the unintended consequence of that? Is that we're just not seeing guys get enough time?
I think that's true. I think that back when I first came in the league, you had all kinds of time to work with them. And the model has really changed. This is kind of interesting. In the 30 years I was involved in the NFL, the model changed drastically. You used to come in with the players Monday after the game, right? The head coach would talk to the team for 5 minutes, this, that, and the other thing, right? The offensive coordinator would just talk for a couple of minutes, right? Then the line would leave and you'd go in your room and you'd go through the game film and take you 2 hours, take you 3 hours, take you however long it took you to go over it in detail and really do it. Well, the last years in the league, and this is true, I talked to coaches from throughout the league. Well, now the head coach gets in there and he's got a presentation, you know what I mean? And the offensive coordinator's got to go over the goals, you know, but we better get the strength coach in here to talk about what the thing is. And we got to get the trainer, you know, to say, oh, and we got the guy that comes up whose job is be a good guy, you know what I mean? He's got to give them, you know, all kind of social cues for this
That's
week,
an official
you know,
title,
and
then,
and it's unbelievable. I mean, towards the end, I'd sit there and I go, my God, okay. Hey coaches, break up and let's get them out of here. All right, like, get him fresh. Get him out of here. So then you'd be there 45 minutes. You go over the game film. You're racing through the film. You go, we got to go. And they're gone. It's like, what the heck? You know, and I think it's the way it is. I think that I think in general, many different businesses are that way now. You know, that there's a lot of layers in everything. And I think that's had a significant impediment on development of linemen.
It feels like they're not going to go back the other way, right? Once you started sort of taking away and protecting players in terms of practice time, they're not suddenly going to roll it back just because there's an offensive line issue or development is a problem. Do you think the league needs one of these sort of spring leagues to succeed just for a development system? The XFL, the AAF, whatever it is. Like, the NFL needs to partner with one of these just to get that group of guys that are sort of on the fringe or need some development time reps?
I think that would be good. I don't think they ever will. I think they were disappointed with the way it turned out with, they were trying to do that in Europe.
Yeah. And, NFL Europe.
I think that ship has sailed a little bit. Well, I think the TV ratings are up. I think the merchandising is big. I think from the big perspective that the league is very, very healthy.
Sure.
And they probably don't see the need for that.
Right.
All right. I think that's really the answer there.
Well, I think
it'd be good for it.
Yeah.
I know I talked about the way that the league has changed in terms of layers and individual team. There's one, I have a player for the Patriots. It's not that way at New England. You walk in and it says, do your job, right? Yeah. And you may be there 10 hours if you got to be. You know what I mean? And so I think some of the old-fashioned values in coaching probably have a little bit of merit today.
It's a tricky balance with the league thing because, like, NFL Europe was too expensive, right? So they didn't want any part of that, wound that up. But they did, like, they were quite involved with the AAF. Like, that was the one they seemed to want to succeed. And then obviously finances dictated otherwise, you know, certain people didn't have the money they said they were going to have. And that whole thing went to hell. But it feels like somewhere there's a little part of the NFL that sort of recognizes the benefit, even if not the need, of that kind of development process that they're not directly involved with, but can kind of farm people out to.
The interesting thing to me is from the player's perspective, it seems like every time they get back to the table to negotiate, they're negotiating for less time and less practice time, and they want that. And a lot of that's concussion driven. And I think I understand why, but it might be having a negative effect on their development as players or their earning potential as players or whatever it might be. So there is a tough give and take there because they think they're doing something better for their health, probably practicing less, probably doing less, and maybe hurting their own development. The one other thing I'll add here too is our grades through the years have showed of all the positions that can make a jump in year three or four, it's offensive line. And I don't know if that meshes with what you've seen through the years, but there are certain, like what Josh Allen did at quarterback, going from not so good to superstar last year is rare for quarterbacks. They usually somewhat have it or don't pretty early, and you have an idea of where they're going to land. But we've seen a lot of offensive linemen get better in years three, four, and five because it does feel like it's more of a reps position, technique position, strength, man strength position, right? When you become 25, 26 years old. Have you seen that through the years? Does that mesh with things you've seen?
Yeah, it's so technical. I'll give you one example. There's a college player, a prominent college player that I work with, right? He'll be a first-round draft pick right now, that when he sets, can you see my feet on there? Okay, here we go. Here's my feet. When he sets for a guy out here, all right, his footwork with his inside foot right now goes back and then out, back and then out, like an L, all right? Well, the proper way that the inside foot should slide if you're going to block that way is on a 45, like this. Well, when he's going back and over and that guy's coming like this, well, guess who wins? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're not getting a spot.
Now, this guy wins because he's a way better athlete than anybody else. You know what I mean? So, but when he gets to the NFL, if he goes back and then over, you know, Chase Young is going to hit the quarterback, right? So those little things, you know, they have to learn. And, oh, yeah, how hard is that to do? Well, you go out there and do that full speed now, you know, when so it takes time, and that's just one little technical example of things that they have to learn.
Yeah, we've seen that with linemen, right? They take a little bit longer sometimes.
And that's the kind of thing you presumably can't be working on during the season. Like, it's an off-season thing only in terms of we have to change something about your technique, right?
It's hard to you can make changes during the season, but they have to be gradual.
Right.
We talked about that. So you mentioned Tom House. He was a guest on the show last year, just before the Super Bowl. He's worked with Tom Brady, various other quarterbacks through the years. We talked about this with Joe Thomas on the show, the idea of an offensive line coach and what your job is when you're working for the Bengals or the Cowboys in the season and getting guys right. How different is that from like what you're doing right now, which is having clients and working with them individually in the offseason? And should a team think of those things as two different roles, like a technique coach or an individual coach, and then a guy getting you ready for Chase Young and, you know, understanding the game plan and various things.
I've got a couple dozen clients that right now, NFL and high caliber college guys, that I watch every week. And I, you know, comment things that they need to work on, and I help them prepare for the guy they're going to go against. I ask all, you're going to find this hard to believe, but I interview every NFL player I can find, and I say to him, I said, how much time do they spend talking about how you have to block Chase Young? Exactly how, not just, hey, go block him. You know what I mean? And some teams will say, oh, they talk about 5 minutes on Wednesday. They might say, oh, geez, he went to Ohio State. They may say that about the guy. You know what I mean? Some teams might not say anything at all. More teams are like that. They're like, hey, you're a pro. You got to know how to block that guy, you know? And some teams will do more, right? But that's a minority. Well, what's going on here? Well, NFL football is so complicated, right? Oh, we got to do this. We got to be ready for that audible. Oh, they're in this tip. It's probably going to be that stun. It's, we got to communicate this. What's the call, you know? And with the time that you have, they spend all their time basically on assignments and game plan, right? And they don't spend much time at all. Or Monday after the game, this is what happens. They watch, they got their 45 minutes to watch the film, right? First play, the coach says, oh, the right guard, you got it, right? Then the next play, they skip the next one. Third, oh, the quarterback should audible here. Be ready next time we get this situation. Here's an audible, right? Fourth one, right tackle, what are you doing? Look at that. You're jumping off sides. What are you thinking, you know? So by all of a sudden, it's 10 plays, and you haven't said anything to the left tackle because he blocked himself. He blocked his guy 10 times in a row.
Yeah.
Right. So he never effectively gets coached. But what a personal coach does, which is what I do, what a personal coach does is I watch that left tackle every play. And I say, hey, yeah, look at your cutoff block here. Yeah, you got him blocked, but look at your stance. My God, look at that. And you see that first step? Well, it's because your stance, you know, and you got to fix that, you know. And so I think there is value in personal coaching, much like Tom House does with NFL quarterbacks. And I do that with offensive linemen.
The game plan aspect of it is interesting to me too, because again, I reference this all the time too. When Zach Robinson worked for us, he's now offensive coach for the Rams, and we would podcast every week about quarterbacks. I thought he was so good at knowing quarterbacks and knowing if I was playing defense against this guy, here's what I would do, right? And I do, and I always wonder when I talk to defensive coaches, it feels like they're just worried about the scheme. Like, here are the plays they run. Here's what we have to do defensively to stop those plays. But you're talking about, here's what Chase Young does. Here's what a player does. Or as a defensive coach, here's what Tom Brady likes to do. Here's what Dak Prescott likes to do. Here's what they don't like to do. Here's how we need to attack them. I'm always curious how much of game planning is player driven, or how much of it is just, it's just the scheme. Here's what they run. We have to stop what they run. And is it too focused on scheme?
They study it themselves. I think there's three levels to knowing how to block somebody, all right? We'll just use Chase Young for an example, all right? That, okay, a team might say, okay, Chase Young, here's his three favorite moves, blah, 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 right? They might tell a guy that. It's great information, right? I say, when I break down a player, first I watch all of his pressures. I get them all up from PFF, right? And I go back historically, and I watch what moves he actually gets pressures on. I don't watch his last 30 rushes, right? Because why do I want to study rushes that don't work? You know, so I gather up all of his pressures, right? And then, so I list what his moves are that worked, right? And then I make a list of, okay, what moves doesn't he have? Okay, that's important to know.
Yeah.
Right? And then the third thing is I synthesize those together and I come up with the guys I work with, I call them one thoughts. And one thoughts mean this, right? That some guys, when I'll set to, I won't tell you what the one thought is against Chase Young, right? But just one guy might be, I set to my spot, and when I get there, the thing in my mind is, a lot of players will say, oh, geez, they'll get there, and they'll be thinking, oh, he's got a great rip move. No, because if it's not a rip move, you're dead.
Yeah.
You have to think, what is going to get you in the mindset to block him? Some guys, I get to the spot, and my one thought would be, don't touch him until he touches me. Because he's a hand rusher,
yeah.
Right? One guy might be, if he's a bull rusher, my one thought when I get to the spot is protect my numbers. Just keep my numbers down, you know? One guy, I might get to the spot, and he's got a really good outside hand knockdown, and my one thought is keep my outside hand back or work my track. Or you come up with thoughts to block players. And that's kind of the process that the guys that are really good, I think that's what they do.
So when teams are looking to scout players at the college level, how important is kind of athleticism versus production? And I think it's interesting from a coaching perspective, we always get the feeling that if you're a coach, you're sort of chasing the guy that's built the right way, that's got the right athleticism, that's got all the tools, working on the basis that you can fix anything technique that's wrong with him, that's potentially holding his production back at the college level. Does that happen as much as we think it might? And is that what gets some teams into trouble sometimes when it comes to
when you evaluate players right now? I don't say this to self-promote. I say it because I believe it's true. My last pick that I had at the Bengals, Cedric Oboye, didn't work out, right? Virtually every other player I had that I drafted in the first three rounds ended up being a starter and a good player over 20 years, right? So the reason why they kept me around here so long is because I could draft and, you know, get players to play, right? I had a really good record of that. And this is the thing that I think is lost. Coaches will typically, when they evaluate someone, they're looking for a productive guy. They're looking for a guy that they can plug in there right away and he's going to do a good job. That would be the stereotype coach analysis, right? A stereotype scout would be a guy who's looking for traits, right? And the traits are what drives everything, his speed, his size, his, you know, change of direction and so forth, all the different traits there are, flexibility, competitiveness, and football intelligence. And so he's looking at traits. And so you have these draft meetings where coaches and scouts are butting heads. You know, they're disagreeing on players, right? Well, to me, it's both, right? And the thing that ties it both together is production, right? And what I used to do is, yeah, I looked for production, I looked for traits, but then the actual grade that the guy had. You know, how effective was he? And that kind of marries it. And then you can kind of put them in the draft spot, you know, exactly where they're at. I think it's both. I really do. I don't think it's one or the other. Some people get enamored with, oh, we can do this. The big one, remember Aaron Gibson, the big tackle at Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. He was, you know, a high
380
pick.
Pounds or so, was he? Am I thinking of the right?
Yeah. And he was... His family were acrobats, you know, and he had tremendous flexibility. He could do the splits. He could, at 360 pounds or whatever, could sit on the ground, put his body completely flat, you know, between with his legs spread. And everyone's like, oh, my God, you see how flexible he is? Oh, my God, he's a freak. He's so flexible. Yeah, but you know what? He was a little slow, all right? And if you're a little slow... It's like baseball again. If you can't hit the curveball, you can't play in the major leagues, right? Yeah. If you've got a trait that is a definite weakness, you got a hard time playing pro football.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of where it is. It's a big factor, a big process of trying to evaluate a prospect.
I want to talk value of positions in a second, but first we got to give a shout out to our friends over at Fantrax. Fantrax is free. Fantasy Football League Manager is the most customizable, easy to use, feature-rich platform in the entire industry. PFF is playing our leagues on Fantrax this season because they feature multi-team trades, bonus points for touchdowns of different yardage. You can create a free account now using promo code PFF at Fantrax.com/PFF, and you get a chance to win a trip to any regular season game this year for you and your entire league. Plus $6,000. It's promo code PFF at Fantrax.com/PFF. Positional value, one of those things, again, that from an analytics standpoint, we talk about all the time. Historically, everybody, you know, left tackle makes all the money, right tackle, you know, not as much. What are your thoughts on the value of left tackle versus right tackle in today's NFL? Tackle versus guard. And if you think tackle is more valuable, should, despite your evaluations, should you always give a player a chance to play tackle just to see if he could do it and then kick him into guard if you think tackle's a more valuable position?
Oh, I think there's value to that. Yes, I think those are all – left tackle still is a premier spot. And the biggest reason is because, you know, the quarterback generally can't see that. you know, right-handed quarterbacks, which most of them are. I think the real thing, though, when you're developing a line, I say you got to have three, right? What does three mean? I think you got to have, to be a good line, you got to have three of your guys that are above average players at their position, right? If you have three, you got a good line.
Yeah.
Right. The mistake a lot of times people will make is say, oh, geez, we don't have a left tackle. We're going to take, we got to take, we, this left, our left tackle's hurt, and you got to have a great left tackle to play. So we're going to take this guy who's, we think is, you know, he got a chance to be pretty good, you know, and we're going to pass up on this guard who we think is a, you know, a rare player, maybe an upper level player, you know, but we need a left tackle. So we're going to take the left tackle. You see it all the time.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's a mistake.
Yeah.
Because you got to get to three. You got to figure out how to get to three.
Are you saying creep back toward average? Is he saying what we're saying?
Well, does it matter which three? So if you have three above average offensive linemen, does it matter which three positions those are?
You'd ideally like it to be your left tackle, your right tackle, and your center is what you, ideally what you'd want.
You say you can hide your guards a little bit.
You can. A little bit easier. You can send the center over to the side. You can double, whatever, right? But the point is, I can't necessarily dictate which of those three it's going to be, but I'm going to get to three rather than I'm going to try to find a great left tackle or right tackle, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that part just makes sense, right? Instead of
it makes sense, but it's not really done very often. You know, you see teams all the time. They'll go get, they need a tackle. They're going to take a tackle. You see it at quarterback. Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, all this time of year, you know, a college guy will, you know, oh yeah, he'll be a second rounder, he'll be a second. And then all of a sudden, the week before the draft, they all go in the top five picks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, really? Did they all of a sudden just change? You know? And hey, you can draft a quarterback that you think's going to be a quarterback, but if he's not, you still don't have a quarterback.
What are your thoughts on different run schemes, running gap and zone, and having a mix versus the old Alex Gibbs outside zone scheme? He's like, all we do is run outside zone. You rep it out, and it's just master this one thing, and you'll be great. You guys mixed it up quite a bit with the Bengals through the years. Is there a challenge in teaching that, not mastering one thing versus keeping defenses off balance?
I think if you're a team that when Alex ran the wide zone and they were tremendously successful, they would get players that could run those. And typically you're looking at smaller, quicker players who can run, they can cut block, they can get in space, they can sustain, you know, they can do all that kind of stuff. Don't pass block as well, right?
Yeah.
So they run a lot of nakeds and bootlegs and play action and all that kind of stuff. And then they throw a lot of three steps and so forth. Well, okay. We were always more suited towards, you know, a quarterback-driven offense, you know, with Carson Palmer and so forth, different guys. And so you want big linemen with good feet, pass block, you know, it helps. And so we always had big linemen with good feet. Now, what could they do best? Well, they could generally, you know, run inside a little better. They can double team. They can gap block. They can pass block. Those are the things they can do. Not so good at the Y zone techniques, right? And so I think that depends on where your offense goes, you know. And the 49ers fascinate me because, yeah, Shanahan's a wide zone guy, but they run every scheme there is.
Yeah. It feels like the NFL generally is kind of, there's less extreme offenses in terms of we run wide zone only and that's all we do, and we want 285-pound linemen that can all run laterally. And then you get a few of these offenses that were just all we do is run gap. We have these 330-pound monsters. Now everybody runs a little bit of everything. I wonder if that's contributed to the sort of lowering of the standard, because now everybody's chasing the same guys, right? When you had all those different systems, the guys for the Alex Gibbs offense were not even looking at the guys for the gap systems over here and vice versa. So there
was in the minority, and he could get a player that would be good for their system in the third or fourth round.
Yeah. So there was,
if you wanted a similar player in a drop back system, you know, you'd have to take him in the first round.
Right.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's part of the reason now why the standard overall is a bit lower, because like everybody is chasing the same style of player. And there aren't as many, you know, wildly extreme systems that are sort of chasing those guys that are freely available.
I think that's probably true.
There you go. See?
You're right. Wow, you're pretty sharp, Sam. Look at that. can we wrap it up with this? Are you, do you feel comfortable commenting on the Bengals' decision to draft Jamar Chase over Penei Sewell?
Oh, no.
How do you
look what we're doing?
Well, it's a debate we've had 900 times on this podcast. Why not get a different?
Well, let me. What position does Jamar Chase play?
Yeah, he's an offensive line guy. Where do you think he's going?
I have an idea of where he's going to lean. So the debate was obviously wide receiver first and then a lineman in the second round, because we know that was a need for the Bengals, versus Penei Sewell in the first round and maybe a receiver in the second round to get that trio. So fair to say that you would take Penei because you're biased.
Let me put it this way. If you got two players with equal grades, a left tackle and wide receiver, I would take a left tackle.
If you had drafted Penei Sewell, you've got Jonah Williams, who has played on the right side before. They just signed Riley Reiff on a one-year deal at right tackle. What does your offensive line look like with Penei in Cincinnati?
I'm not going there.
Okay, I'm not going there. Okay, that was...
If you were, like, did you ever... So obviously there's various ways of protecting the quarterback better, right? There's upgrading on the offensive line, but there's also, hey, quarterback, throw the ball quicker, you know? Get it out of your hands faster. Did you in your career ever sort of push back and say, hey, like, can we get him to speed up a little bit? We're hanging the offensive line out to dry a little bit here. I can do what I do, but you can also work from your end as well.
Oh, I think it's collaborative. I think when a team has an offensive line coach who's experienced, then that guy has a lot of influence in all the positions. Because really, if it's not clean up front, nothing else is going to matter.
Right.
You know that. We had those discussions before, and we were lucky that Ken Zampezi was a quarterback coach almost the entire time, and he was really good at getting the quarterbacks get rid of the ball, and Dalton got rid of the ball.
Yeah.
You know, Palmer got rid of the ball. They all got rid of the ball, and Kelly Smith didn't get rid of the ball. You know.
That's true. Keeley had some struggles. The great QB class of 1999. I did mention this to you off air. I use the 2015 Bengals as this consistent example to say having four guys who can get open protects the offensive line. Not that you needed protection. You guys had a good offensive line in 2015. Andy Dalton had a career year statistically. AJ Green, Marvin Jones, Mohamed Sanu was the three. Tyler Eifert was kind of baby Gronkish that year. I mean, it was like the one full healthy season of Tyler Eifert. And you're looking at this offense, and it was one of the things that opened up my eyes. So two things happened that year. You guys were awesome offensively and had four guys to throw to. Tom Brady lost Julian Edelman at one point during the year. All of a sudden, his time to throw goes way up because he didn't have that quick outlet. All of a sudden, their offensive line started to look bad because he didn't have the guy to throw to. So that was one of the things that opened up my eyes a little bit to that relationship of, if you do have three guys who are getting open, maybe you can get by with a lesser offensive line if you're getting rid of it.
Dalton had one of the fastest times to throw in the NFL that year. And actually, the top five is an interesting list of names. Peyton Manning, fastest in the NFL. Tom Brady, second fastest in the NFL. Phillip Rivers, Andy Dalton, and then Roethlisberger. So that was a good group of guys getting rid of the ball fast.
And we're seeing, you mentioned Rivers, the Indianapolis Colts offensive line off to a slow start this year, in part because of injuries and moving people around. But Carson Wentz is more than half a second longer than Phillip Rivers just last year to this year. So
you know, you lose sight of that. I was down last week watching Carolina play the Saints live. And you lose sight when you're watching television, football on television, you lose perspective of how fast the game really is.
Yeah.
You know, it's the first time I saw McCaffrey play live, you know, and I couldn't get over how quick he is.
The quickness is incredible, right?
And the other one, I'm stumbling here, Burns, right? Burns is unfrickin' believable.
Yeah.
How quick he is.
Yeah.
I saw him rush on Armstead, right? He ran all the way around. He took a swing at the quarterback. He fell down on the ground, you know, and then the quarterback scrambled, and he got up and he chased him downfield 10 yards when he ran out of bounds. It was like, oh my God, Brian Burns is unbelievable.
Yeah.
If Caroline was better, he'd be a household name.
Yeah.
And he might be on Thursday night against the Texans.
Oh God.
Here we go, baby. Your big game. You're excited. Davis Mills.
Davis Mills.
Panthers defense is off to a great start. Really good game against Zach Wilson, the Jets. Really good game against the Saints. Saints looked awesome in week one, but not against this Panthers defense that by Friday morning people are going to be talking about as the best in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, the schedule for Carolina is extremely nice looking. They're going to have a pretty good record pretty deep into the season, I would say.
Well, this was fun. You have anything else to follow up
I'm
with?
Good. What do you got, Mr. Cool Clinic?
I am the four-time keynote speaker at the Cool Clinic. Uh-huh. Hopefully they'll have me back next year.
Yeah, you're back. You're back. But
thank you.
He was never really keynote.
No, I know.
He was a speaker. Yeah. Yes, he was.
And I mean, you let him in the building.
I don't know about keynote, but
just between us, what they quite literally did was threw 15 minutes my way during like the pizza break. So all the guys were going to get pizza. Like, oh yeah, we'll give you some time.
You're like the intermission joke teller.
It's like right after Dante Scarnecchia. Yeah. Like, yeah, we'll throw Steve out there during pizza break.
You're like the comedian that like comes on and fills 15 minutes while Guns N' Roses is warming up in the back.
Yeah, but I earned my spot. We'll call it keynote. Four-time keynote speaker.
Okay.
That's what we'll say. I'll be back. I'm one of them. One of those one of them. I've got the body for it at 6'8".
Sort of. You'd have to,
6'10", almost 300.
You'd have to pack on some weight. There's no anchor there.
What could you do with this frame, Paul? What could you – could you get me –
I teach you how to throw a baseball.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's all I can do. Anyway, Andrew Whitworth, let's wrap it up with this. Andrew Whitworth, you mentioned earlier, he's our age, Sam. He's 39. Is he a Hall of Famer?
I think he is.
Yeah, that was your guy for a while.
Yeah, I mean, Hall of Fame, a big part of the Hall of Fame is, how much you accumulate. You know what I mean? And he's been obviously played a tremendous number of games. But the thing that's great about PFF is they actually have data now. I mean, when they had the Hall of Fame discussions, they'd all get around and they'd talk about this guy and that guy. And
started 150 games he was good. Or something.
And now they know when they pull up Whitworth's PFF grades. I told the guys I work with, I said, I put his picture up on a PowerPoint when I work with a guy. He says, okay. I said, you know who's got the best career blocking grade alive in your lifetime? That guy, Andrew Whitworth.
Right? I like it.
Because his numbers are unbelievable. Like you said, Joe Thomas, we were talking before the show. You mentioned, go ahead, mention what you said.
I mean, I think Joe Thomas in a weird way is going to help Whitworth's case for the Hall of Fame because Joe Thomas, slam dunk, first ballot Hall of Famer. He's going to walk in the second he's eligible. And Whitworth's numbers, grade, everything stacks up pretty closely to Joe Thomas. So at some point, somebody is going to be making his case, in that room to all the Hall of Fame voters, and essentially just like for like comparison, this guy we didn't even talk about, this guy has the same career.
Right.
Why are we stalling on him?
Using grades maybe to defend it.
Using everything, grades, the pressure data, all of it.
It's great. I know guys are getting paid whether or not they grade in PFF. When I'll talk to an NFL guy who's considering working with me, I pull up the list and I say, okay, here's the top graders. You know what he's making? Look at it. All these guys, because the agents, when they go to negotiate with the general manager, what can they negotiate? Oh, we don't think he's good. Oh, we think he's good. That's what they used to do in the old days.
Right.
Now they got stats. They can say, hey, look, this guy's fifth in the league at right guard.
Yeah.
He should get paid like one of the best right guards.
5 seasons in Whitworth's career where he's allowed 1 or fewer sacks. Joe Thomas, when he had 2. 1.5, you can't. The last season.
This isn't. You don't have to make.
Who coached that guy?
You don't have to pull Joe Thomas. Joe Thomas had. Look. Joe has had Johnny Manziel and Josh McCall. These dudes holding the ball for 3 seconds back there.
Just
Come
saying.
On, don't bring Joe down.
No, I'm just saying.
Joe's still the standard, and love Andrew as well. But they're both guests. They're both friends of the show.
That's true.
They've both been on the show here, so we just want as many of our guests to be in the Hall of Fame as possible. So we're pushing for both Joe and Andrew when he finally retires.
I don't think we need to worry about Joe is my point.
No, we don't.
Yeah.
I think he'll be okay without us. Mm. Anyway, Paul, this was great. Really appreciate, having you on here and talking some offensive line.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody for tuning in. It's our live Wednesday show. Appreciate everybody on YouTube. Hit that thumbs up before you leave. And we'll be back here tomorrow previewing all of the Week 3 games. See you guys tomorrow.